You're listening to the Bail in the Midwest podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Bail in the Midwest podcast, where we explore a variety of topics related to bail, pretrial release, and the criminal justice system in the Midwest. My name is Shane Rolfe. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Kansas Bail Agents Association, and I've worked in this field for the past 35 years. Now, bail bondsmen are often asked, what do you do? And after a while, we develop a few kind of pat answers. Quote, we make sure defendants show up to address charges against them, for example. The slogan of the Kansas Bail Agents Association is bail agents assure justice. Some who want to distance themselves from the bail bondsman label or get away from the dog, the bounty hunter image will describe their jobs in more innocuous terms like pretrial offender management or explain that we help crime victims get their day in court. But however we describe it, those who are still curious will always ask, how do you become a bail bondsman? Did you have to go to school? And while the paths to becoming a bail bondsman are as varied as the bondsmen themselves, the educational aspect of becoming a bail bondsman had, for the longest time, been either non-existent or was limited to the education requirements to get a general insurance license, which often had little bearing on the actual day-to-day job of a professional bail bondsman. After all, knowing how to write a vehicle insurance policy has nothing to do with evaluating the risk in posting bond for a criminal defendant. My guest today was one of the early advocates for establishing bail bond-specific continuing education requirements in his state and has helped many other states, including my state of Kansas, develop similar programs and requirements. Charles White is the past president of the Tennessee Association of Professional Bail Agents. Charlie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Shane. Appreciate it.
Now, I gave you a little bit of a short shrift there, just mentioning that, you know, not that it was nothing, but you were past president of the TAPBA. You've had quite a varied career. Can you kind of give us a little bit of your backstory on the things you've done, both in bail and the criminal justice system?
Certainly. Because of my varied past history, that is why I have traveled the country and spoke on criminal justice and bail matters. I started out around 1975 with the Chattanooga Police Department. The first 90% of my year with the police department, I worked undercover narcotics. After that, you know, I went into the bonding business. That was like 1981. This is something that I've done a little over 43 years, I believe, 43 years. And during my tenure as a bondsman, I was living in Georgia and operating a bail business across the line, Chattanooga, Tennessee. It's a bordering city. And one of our magistrate judges in Catoosa County, Georgia, where I resided, he took a position with the University of Georgia. So Governor Joe Frank Harris of Georgia appointed me as a magistrate judge to fulfill an unexpired term. And that was about a 3.5-year appointment. And as a magistrate judge, I did first appearance hearings. I set bonds. I did probable cause hearings, issued search warrants, and did a few civil cases. But primarily, it was anything that a municipal or sessions court judge in Tennessee would do, or whatever lower level court judges you have in Kansas, not the higher court, criminal courts, recorded records, but the lower courts that does traffic and misdemeanors and things of that nature, and then bound over to the higher court if it's a felony case or something of a more serious nature. And continue doing bonds in Tennessee. In 1996, you mentioned about our continuing education. We had legislation come through in the state of Tennessee. There was a study group called the Futures Committee. The Futures Committee consisted of college professors, news editors, and everybody in the world that had an opinion but knew nothing about the bail bonding business.
Right.
And their job was to come up with this blue ribbon panel, some kind of proposal to submit to the governor to improve the criminal justice system and bail bonding. And lo and behold, where did they go to get their examples and their ideas? was the very close bordering state of Kentucky, which had no bondsmen. It didn't approve of bondsmen or didn't think they were necessary. So our futures committee came back and submitted the paperwork to the governor, Don Sundquist at the time, that their recommendation was to do away with the bail bonding business and go similar to Kentucky with a cash bail or some type of pretrial release system.
Well, and that was pretty rampant back in the 90s, if I recall, the mid-90s. That was going around all over the place. But go ahead.
Right. And so we were able, because of our state association, to get a meeting with the governor. You know, we had close ties with the Senate and the House majority leaders at the time, and they were able to get us before the governor, and we were able to have a sit-down conference with him. And we just asked him, you know, what is it? What's the complaints with us? And it basically evolved then, as it does now, was, you know, we had a bad reputation. We were our own worst enemies. We were always shooting ourselves in the foot. We once had a seat at the table of criminal justice, but we had lost our seat because of some of the things that we'd done and some of the things that had gone on with our, in our industry. And we asked Governor Sundquist, what could we do to improve our image, or what could we do to help ourselves? And he said basically the only thing was continuing education. And so we committed to start immediately continuing education and to start off by training image and ethics and professionalism within the bail industry. And he agreed to give us 1 year. The legislation had already gone through the House and Senate, signed. All it lacked was the signature of the governor to go into effect. But he agreed to leave it on his desk for a year to give us an opportunity to make some improvement, to get continuing education established, and to give us, new life, breathe new life into our industry in the state of Tennessee. And that's what occurred. And so we were able to get the continuing education started. We were able to start off with the image and ethics and professionalism. And we satisfied the governor, so he didn't enact that piece of legislation. And we lived and breathed on. So I kind of say it was like we were resurrected. We were in the grave and the dirt was already being cast upon us. But we were able to come out of it make ourselves whole again. That's why I don't apologize to anyone in Tennessee for having continuing education. Everybody complains about it. No one likes to go and sit there for 8 hours and listen to a speaker tell them something that they've been doing 10 years, 25 years, or 3 weeks in some cases, or 5 months. I've seen agents in 5 months, they think they know as much as you and I in the 35 and the 42 years that we have. And they don't, but they don't realize they don't. And I would try to tell them, let's at least come and listen. If you don't do anything else, network with the people there, change business cards, so that if you have a skip in Newport, Tennessee, and you're from Memphis and don't know where Newport is, pull out his card and call him and ask him if he'll help you. You know, that was worth the attendance of the class, at least.
One of the things that I've noticed in attending classes, because I've been a presenter at some of ours, and I'll talk about that in a second here, but it is really such a unique industry that, you know, you don't really have the same life experiences while you're working in this industry that most other places do. And actually being able to go and meet and talk with other people in the field, and you find that they have the same experiences that you do. And it really is easy, even though they're competitors, sometimes direct competitors, they still have those same experiences. And there's still that connection with other people in the same field because they're dealing with the same client base and the same court systems and stuff along those lines. It's nice to, you know, in one sense, to have somebody else to talk to. I mean, some of my best friends in the bail industry. Now, Granted, they're not working in the same area I am, so we don't have that direct competition. But are people that are working in the same field in other parts of the state that I can call and go, okay, what's going on with you guys? How is this affecting you? And you know, you just have those same experiences, other things that you can talk to about within your field. And it is an all-encompassing field. I mean, when we're bail bondsmen, you know, we're on 24/7. I mean, you don't really think about it that way, but you know, you're always on. And so having somebody else with that same experience is nice to have.
24/7, 365. Exactly. I'll take it a step even further. You know, and I know that you've met Corky, and Corky's my best friend. He traveled to Kansas with me.
Yeah, I remember.
Corky and I are competitors. Our offices are virtually have been next door to each other, right down the hall from each other. And when we're going to jail, make a bond, we'll elbow each other and look like people on roller derby. If you remember that from back in the days with the little roller skates and the little helmets on, elbowing the crap out of each other, trying to get a step ahead. But yeah, Corky and I hunt together, fish together. He's like a brother to me. He's as almost as close to me as my brother and I. And there wouldn't anything I wouldn't do for Corky and his family, and there's nothing he wouldn't do for me and my family. But we're competitors. But through that being competitors and our friendship, we've been able to serve on boards together, make a lot of headways into writing legislation, working on things, because he knows and he gets, just like I know and I get, the things that we've visualized over the years. He's one of the few people that's been in it about as long as I have in the area. So to go back to what you said, it is well worth it to have those friends, those pockets of friends. But you know, if you got one, even if he's next door neighbor and a competitor, you know, it's worth keeping that relationship open. And you know, because there's enough out there for all of us. You know, the problem is. It's when they start getting greedy and somebody wants it all, and right. It starts cutting the corners. You know, they'll pay a jailer or they'll pay somebody to give them a little bit of information or a little bit of insight or something. And that's where you get into your problems. That's where we step on our own toes and our own foot. We get investigations where you go out there and you don't do your due diligence to verify your defendants in the residence you're fixing to go into to take them out on a skip and things. And that's where we get ourselves into trouble and have the bad press. And everybody thinks, you know, the worst about us. And I don't know what to do about that, because for years I preached we're our own worst enemy. We need to clean up our own act.
Talking still about continuing education, I've been a presenter a couple times at our continuing education. I think the very first year I had a presentation that I gave on the history of bail, so everybody kind of understood where we came from and how we got to where we are now. And then just this past year, I had an hour-long presentation, each of the classes, on bond surrenders and motions for judgment on bond, which is how they enforce bonds here in Kansas, and detailing all the relevant statutes and case law and how best to protect yourself on a bond forfeiture from a legal standpoint. But we can't do those same presentations year after year. If we just came and gave the same thing year after year, they'd really complain about having to attend the class. How do you guys in Tennessee try and keep things relatively new year after year? I mean, I know you've got to cover some basics every year, but how do you mix in some new stuff each year to kind of cycle that and keep it fresh?
The one thing we go through is bail law. And the bail law, obviously, you have changes in legislation. So we do the changes in the legislation. What is new that has been added and what is old that has been omitted? And from there, we bring in different guest speakers. We've used Alex Price. I don't know if you know Alex. You should. He's been at PBS. And he's been in Tennessee many times.
He was actually on the podcast here a couple, three episodes ago.
Oh, well, okay. Then you know Alex Price. Well, Alex is one of the few nationally certified bail enforcement instructors in the country. So, and then we have a young lady, Miss Stewart, that teaches at Quantico about the phones and the information you can get off of Facebook and the social programs and things of that nature. But we give them a little bit more time because they have such in-depth knowledge. From there, we invite guest speakers like a district attorney, a sheriff, and of course, I've spoke or been a presenter on many occasions for different subjects, depending on what the subject matter or need was at the time. But we might bring in someone like you to come from Kansas and give us in Kansas, in Tennessee, what you did for Kansas about your paperwork and your forms. And they may not be the same, but they'll be the same, only different, if that makes sense to you. So, and then we look at people from the National Association, PBUS, Topo Padilla goes around to some of the states and he'll speak. And Topo's a pretty good speaker. And then you have some of the surety companies have different people that'll come, like Eric Granoff from AIA or Mike Whitlock from American Sureties. Or at one time there was Nick Wachinski when he was with Lexington. So there's different people. And Nick is someone that's come and spoke in Tennessee several times to give us an update. I think he represents the Pennsylvania bonding companies as an attorney. And then people like that, you know, the some of the lawyers that have lobbied or worked on some of the cases in New York, New Jersey, California, Texas, where they were trying to implement the different programs to do away with the bail bonding industry. And Nick and I worked together on a few things because we found ourselves like-minded. We try to play chess while everybody else is playing checkers. So we're looking at 3 and 5 years down the road. Everybody else is down here trying to do something from what happened last year or do something to help this year. We've already established that, completed that, and we're 3 years, 5 years down the road making something else to help us or to improve or defend at that point, rather than waiting. And we like to be proactive rather than reactive, if you will.
There is the notion that you need to preserve the industry first, or there's nothing to fight over.
Right, exactly. I agree.
So let's talk about Chattanooga just a little bit. When I was in high school, we did a trip. My high school had what they called an interim period between semesters because they were trying to emulate sort of like college stuff. And so during that 2 weeks in between semesters, they were what they called mini courses. And so one of my years, we had a mini course where we traveled all through the South to visit Civil War battle sites. And of course, and Chattanooga is one of those places. And so we were in Chattanooga. That's my only experience being in there. We took the hike up Lookout Mountain and, you know, went to visit the Rock gift shop and all the stuff that's up there. I've still got old pictures looking down on the city from the mountaintop there. But looking at that city and where it's located geographically, that's got to create sort of some unique challenges from a bail bond perspective, because you're right on the state line with Georgia and pretty close to state line with Alabama and not that far from the Carolinas and really only 100 miles south of Kentucky, which just creates its own problem. So as a bail bondsman in that area, how do you deal with multiple states and making sure you comply with all the laws in those states and deal with everything?
Do you know what the word Chattanooga means?
I do not.
In the Cherokee Native American language, it means lookout.
Ah, okay.
And from Lookout Mountain, there's a point there that you can see 7 states from that particular point on Lookout Mountain. And you correctly say, in Chattanooga, I can be in probably 3 states in 15 minutes or less.
Which also means your clients can be in 3 states in 15 minutes or less.
Well, my clients, a lot of them reside in Georgia and Alabama and work and play in Chattanooga.
Right.
And some of them reside as far as Kentucky for the Nashville, Crossville, and Cookeville areas a little bit north of me. And then up in Bristol and Johnson City, you're across the border. Bristol is the city of Bristol. One side of the street is Bristol, Tennessee. The other side of the street is Bristol, Virginia. And so there's bars that is built with half the bar in Virginia and half the bar in Tennessee. So if the Virginia police come in, everybody walks over to the Tennessee side. If the Tennessee police come in, they walk over to the Virginia side. And then from there, you've got Mountain City, Tennessee, which across the line from it is Boone, North Carolina. So we have, you know, always had to live with the fact that our clientele can run across the border virtually, you know, at any time. So you try to get those good co-signers, good indemnitors, get good information, but the best you could do is sometimes you'll not get enough, especially if they go to Kentucky. Kentucky's hard because they don't like to let anyone come in. But I will say this. In my 42 years, I've never been refused help or service in Kentucky, but I've always gone to the sheriff's office, taken all of my paperwork, introduced myself, told them what I was there for, showed them all the supporting facts and the paperwork, photographs of the defendant, and the addresses and information that I've had. And generally speaking, you know, I've had them even say, well, Mr. White, if you will wait right here, we'll go pick him up for you. We know exactly where he's at. I know his mom and his dad. Well, I had one time said, well, I suggest you fellas going back to Chattanooga. And I said, why is that, Sheriff? He said, because my baby sister wouldn't appreciate y'all going and getting my nephew. So, you never know what you're going to get into. But it makes it challenging, and each state has their own different nuances. Virginia is the toughest. You know, they don't accept anybody from anywhere. You got to be a Virginia bail enforcement agent going through their classes that are put on by the state of Virginia. It costs you about $1,200, and it's 40 hours of continuing education. But you can go there and hire one of their people and go with them. You know, it just, you know, it's kind of like going to Texas or some of these other places.
Right, and I think that's becoming more common too. You know, just the states want to have a little bit more control over people that are you know, picking people up in their state.
Yeah, we've had some legislation that keeps coming, showing its head, because we've had some out of state bounty hunters or fugitive recovery agent, bail enforcement agent, whatever you want to refer to them as. We call them bounty hunters because that's what our legislators call them. If you look in their statutes, they refer to them as bounty hunters. I don't like the term bounty hunter, but that's what they use, so that's what we use. But at any rate, they come in from out of state. They don't do their due diligence, verify the defendant or seem at an address. They'll just go kick in the door and start dragging people out and end up with the police there and three of them getting arrested. Or, you know, it's just something always from people from Alabama, people from Kentucky, or people from Georgia. And it just, you know, keeps our legislators upset because they're constituents are calling in and complaining about these out-of-state, they're out-of-town people coming in and they don't know who they are. You know, and it's dangerous. I mean, what would you do if three guys with black outfits on that look like it's SWAT gear and no identifiers, no police badge or nothing, and they're all armed and, you know, peeking in your windows and, you know, going around your property.
Right. Oh, yeah, you know, absolutely.
Where I come from, we have, you know, Mr. Smith Wesson that deals with intruders like that. You
know. And, you know, if that sort of situation really blows up and gets on the news, then suddenly news standing outside your office wanting some sort of comment from you and makes it look like you were somehow involved in it rather than these people from someplace else. So, I mean, it's an image issue.
Many, many times that's occurred. And here's the sad fact. When it's revealed that we were at no fault or there was nothing, you know, no one from our industry had done any wrong, they don't publicize that. They just do the sizzling, titillating facts of bondsmen arrested or bounty hunters assault, or, you know, they do the the sensitization of, you know, the initial act, but they don't do the backdrop when it's found that, oh, this was just three guys doing a home invasion, and they posed or acted like they was bounty hunters. They wouldn't even bounty hunters.
Well, I remember the case in Arizona just like that. It was absolutely a home invasion that, you know, they had some 10-year-old bond piece that they got from somebody years and years ago. And the response was, well, we don't really care that they're not bail bondsmen. They could have been bail bondsmen. So we need to do something about this. Well, you know, could have been. It could have been anything. It could have been aliens. But it's like, you know, what is this could have been? But that was the justification for you know, a crackdown in Arizona.
Yeah, and see, other people beside police and bondsmen saw those articles and got the sense, well, this is a good way to do home invasions.
Right.
And so, you know, I don't know, Shane, it's just, you know, they don't realize that the criminal element's smarter or as smart as their police forces and police officers. They have their own contact system and so their own network. So when you go in and you say, okay, we're not going to charge anybody that shoplifts with a crime. We're just going to let them all go. Well, then you have these organized shoplifting units. Why would they go to Kansas City, Kansas, and get arrested for shoplifting when they can go to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and not be processed? So they send all their people over there to do their shoplifting. So if you're trying to minimize the criminal element in your city or your area by doing away with the shoplifting arrest and charges, all you're doing is inviting them to invade you by masses because you're not, there's no consequences to the acts that they're committing.
Well, and the point you bring up there as far as, you know, the criminals talk to each other and learn from each other is something that gets lost. Because I know that the Arnold Foundation just paid for a study to show that, well, bail reform is really working. Letting all these people out, there were really a small percentage of those people specific who'd been released that were being rearrested. And so that shows it works. And it really misses out on two things. One, you have to actually get caught. You know, if you're going to be committing that crime to show up in those statistics, and it doesn't reflect that, oh, hey, wait a second, my buddy, he got out, you know, for nothing. So if I go commit this same crime, I'm going to get out for nothing. So you lose a lot of the deterrent in the community as a whole with those sorts of arguments. See, and you bring that up perfectly.
It happens within our state because we have some cities that, you know, primarily it's Memphis and Nashville because they're more liberal than Knoxville and Chattanooga. And they drop the small charges for assault, possession of marijuana, or shoplifting in those areas. And that's where they go to commit their crimes. Right. So then you get a city like Kentucky, Knoxville, that says, well, we're going to try that. And guess what? Within 2 months, Knoxville was bombarded. You've got tent cities everywhere. Knoxville just, you know, it's gone downhill fast because of the laxing of the charges and the having to serve the consequences of your actions. They'll go to where they meet the least resistance. And if you don't think MS-13 and all these other guys know where to peddle their drugs, know where to boost the stolen merchandise, know where to get stolen guns. You know, these people are naive. They communicate and they have a system of information just as I guess, efficient as most of the police departments and better than some states, I would say.
Now, if memory serves me correct, and I'm thinking late 80s and 90s, I was doing a lot of legal research at the time on different issues. And Hamilton County came up in a whole bunch of different lawsuits that would seem like it was really quite the hotbed of bail reform, at least as it was envisioned back then. How did you deal with that back in the 80s and 90s? And is bail reform in Hamilton County, is that still a problem now?
No, not so much. That was back in, you know, as I alluded to earlier, that futures study and futures a blue ribbon panel and so forth. That was the beginning, and then in the late 90s was the end of all of that era. But we were able to, you know, just, we've always had a good relationship with our legislators, our senators, and our state representatives. And so we've never asked them for anything other than an opportunity to sit down and talk to them about issues that involve us. You know, just give us the opportunity to explain to you why we have the position we have. And all of them have told us that that was, you know, more than reasonable to ask for. And so once you sit down and you look at these issues as they arise, and you talk on a basic common sense level, legislators get it. You know, what we have to be aware of, that nobody knows our industry like we do. Judges don't know our industry. Clerks don't know our industry. Sheriffs don't know our industry. We sometimes assume everybody knows what we do and how we do it, but those people know a fourth each of what we do. Right. They know what we do within their departments and within their systems, but they don't know what we do with everybody else. If I go to a town, if I come to Kansas and was looking for somebody and needing help or so, I'd come to your office or Dave's office and go in and talk to you about who do I need to talk to in Warrant Division? Who do I need to talk to in the clerk's office? Who do I need to talk to in the DA's office? Who do I need to talk to in the judge's office? Because you know those people. Nobody else knows all of them.
Well, yeah, bail does touch on multiple different aspects of the criminal justice system and even civil justice to a certain extent. You know, that everybody's got their own little, you know, area. And then a lot of times we're bridging between lots of those different areas. So let's touch on a couple items that have been in the news recently and kind of with your experience, kind of get a feel for your take on those things. And in Texas, kind of made the news, a judge recently released an individual who'd been indicted for several violent crimes on two $1 bonds, so a total bond of $2. In doing so, he cited Senate Bill 6, which rolled back the court's ability to give certain signature bonds to certain defendants. And so what he did was just give them a dollar bond. And a similar situation occurred, maybe you saw in the news here in Atlanta, because that's sort of in your area, this past fall, that resulted in a magistrate judge being suspended for a couple of weeks for giving somebody a $1 bond. And when I spoke to some bail bondsmen in Colorado here, you know, a few months ago, they were having similar situations where, you know, ultra-liberal anti-bail judges, when prevented from granting signature bonds by statute or by local rule, are simply setting ridiculously low bonds. You know, often when we as bail bondsmen pursue legislation to limit signature bonds, go, hey, you're getting too far afield on these things. And we make the argument that, hey, give that authority back to the judges to make a decision. We assume that the judges are going to revert back to more normal bonds. So in your estimation, what is the appropriate response when they start, you know, the judges themselves start playing these sorts of games with $1 and $2 bonds?
Those are the implants of George Soros, in my opinion, and people like George Soros. Idealistically, a judge is supposed to be a fair and impartial finder of fact. A bond is supposed to be set at the least amount to assure the defendant's return to court. So I don't think a dollar assures a defendant's return to court. I think they're playing with the system. They want to do these OR bonds or no cash bonds. And so because of legislation, they can't. So they set them at a dollar, which is an insult to the judiciary and the legislators. I think they should be taken before the Board of Judicial Review and maybe sanctioned or considered taking them off the bench, because you're putting your general public at risk, and you're costing your state and county governments funds by handling these people when they should have been on a more reasonable bond to ensure the return to court. That's my opinion.
I would kind of wonder, because we've looked at that before, and it's like, well, this is sort of the who bells the cat sort of argument. You know, who is it that's going to go make that complaint to Judicial Review Board to complain about that? And, you know, then what's your response from all the other judges going to be that you've complained against one of their fellow judges?
I'll tell you what an attorney told me one time. If a rape occurs on the courthouse lawn and nobody reports it, a rape didn't occur. If a judge set a $1 bond and nobody complains, it ain't occurred. Yeah. So somebody's got to be willing. You know, somebody's got to be the, I guess, the sacrificial lamb, if you will, right, to go out there and make the judges do what they should do. And this should be a point of honor to me because, you know, it specifically says to be a fair and impartial finder of fact and to set a bond reasonable enough to ensure the defendant's return to court. Do you think a dollar under those circumstances would return any of those defendants to court?
And no, the answer not even has a cup of coffee.
Yeah, that's that has to be no. Go to Starbucks and try to get a cup of coffee for a dollar.
Right.
You know, and it's not going to happen. So there's no way they can say yes. So it is purely a slap in the face of the system or the slap in the face of the judiciary. So that I would, you know, whisper in the ears of my judiciary, my chairman of Senate judiciary, my chairman of House judiciary, and show them this is what they're doing. This is what they think of the statutes you implement.
Right. This is how they're trying to thumb their nose at you, legislature, for making these changes.
They're going around your intentions or your legislation by doing this. How do we stop it? How can we work together? That's how I would approach it. How can we work together to stop these judges?
Well, that's a good idea. I know that one of the things that in Kansas they're looking at is more legislative oversight for, you know, court appointments, you know, to the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, you know, trying to mirror the federal system a little bit. And they're sort of getting into that now. Another issue that seems to be coming up in our area, and it's in Sedgwick County and it's in Wichita, is the use of so-called what e-bonds, that basically using a form of electronic filing for bonds and seemingly, you know, and when it seems like there's certain advantages. I mean, as a bondsman, you wouldn't have to sit around the jail for hours. You could just, you know, press a few buttons on your computer and ship that bond over to the jail. And in theory, you could work with a smaller staff or cover a larger area. But, you know, some of the negatives on that is it potentially increases the competition in a particular area. If you've got bondsmen from all over the place now trying to provide service there, the companies providing this service are quasi-monopolies, and their fees for doing that are quasi-monopolistic. They're ridiculously high. And it could be an end run around the local bail agent by a statewide general agent, or even a national firm, you know, simply trying to do bonds online. And finally, it does strike me that reducing our role to just money, which is what this would be doing, and if we're not having direct interaction with the defendant, are we really able to guarantee appearance and assure what we're supposed to do as well?
Yes, yes, yes. And yes, to all of the above. And in Hamilton County, Tennessee, Chattanooga, they just implemented e-bonds the first of the year. It's still in the infancy in the initial process. And they're still getting the bugs worked out of it. As I said earlier, I'm retired, so I haven't had any hands-on dealings with it. But some of my friends, Corky, who's still in the business, they're having to, you know, filter through the system and work it out. And the general consensus I've got from the age group of my friends of the bondsmen that have been in 30 years plus, it's not improved anything. If anything, it's made it worse in Hamilton County because you have a group that monitors the intake information on the computer, and they'll send the e-bond in without even talking to the defendant or talking to anybody in the family. So they'll have the bond in there and then get the defendant and then work on the payment for the bond after you they've got the defendant out of jail rather than before they get the defendant out of jail.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, are you seeing a situation there where they then, if they aren't able to work that out, are they putting the people back in custody, or are they just, okay, well, we weren't able to work that out and we're still on this bond? Because I mean, that creates a lot of ill will in and of itself as well if you're tossing people for non-payment.
That's according to who you are. If you're certain people can take them back into the custody and they'll just tear up the original paper. Other people don't have that
Really?
privilege. Yeah.
I mean, I've got a couple of letters sitting on my desk from various jurisdictions around Kansas that, saying, hey, if we find out that you're surrendering people because they didn't pay you, you're not going to write bonds here anymore. You can surrender for lots of other reasons, but that's not one of them, because they don't want us to be engaged in that sort of behavior. I mean, I see it happen now and then, but generally not a whole lot. But I could see how that could get a lot worse.
But if the courts and nobody knows it other than the bondsman and whoever's working at the detention center, and the defendant can go say it, but he's got no paperwork, he's got
Right.
no proof, So I don't know, Just to me, it was another way that you could breed corruption or, give A an advantage over B and C. So I don't know,
I mean,
And like you said, you get to the point where you don't need your local bondsman. You're
right.
going to go to a state or to a national situation, and you can have these large surety companies actually post bond from the Bahamas if they wanted to, where they could have a phone bank in the Cayman Islands or somewhere. I don't know where it's going.
Well, like our notary, if you have a notary, you have to have insurance for that notary. It used to be you'd have to go down to your local insurance agent and get some notary bond written on them. Now you just press a couple buttons on a computer. And I'd hate to see the bail bond industry get to that because I think it loses that connection, that supervision we're supposed to be engaged in.
Right. To guarantee the defendant's appearance in court and the victim's day in court. That's the two things that we basically write an insurance policy guaranteeing the defendant's appearance in court and the victim has their day in court. That's basically what we do.
So you've mentioned that you're largely retired from active bail writing, and I remember in the movie Jackie Brown, I don't know if you saw that, a lot of bail bondsmen saw it. The bail bondsman character talks about retiring, and his partner is all kind of flustered because, how do they manage the winding down of a bail bond business if he wants to retire? You still have to manage the defendants who are still on bond while not really having any revenue come in to pay for picking them up or paying bond forfeitures if things go wrong. I'm seeing a few older bondsmen here in my area stepping back. Generally, they're just kind of slowly taper off the bonds they're writing, tighten up the restrictions they have on who they get out, to where they can sort of wind things down. And extricating yourself from this type of business where it's always there's the next bond down the road can be kind of difficult. I'm just kind of curious how you went around that in your own winding down of your business.
What you said is exactly correct. We call it a book of business. Each of us have a book of business. That's the bonds we've written, and you have open liability and closed liability. I did it a little bit different. I learned this from a friend of mine who was a small businessman. I've often found it's knowledge is learning from your mistakes. Wisdom is learning from other people's mistakes. So I tried to take a little wisdom in this and used a system that he used. So in my areas, my offices, I had what I called managing agents or supervising agents, whatever title you want to give
Right.
them. And these are people that I handpicked and I nurtured and taught a little bit more than just a regular agent. So when I was ready to retire, I offered the office to my managing and supervising agents at no cost to them, other than they managed the runoff and the notification and the handling of the day-to-day business. Let them have the office, let them have the phone number, the whole smear.
Right.
And so that made it easier on me, but it gave them something to work for and them a sense of being a part of something. And, you know, that's kind of how I was almost brought into the business. So I felt like it's, you know, pass it forward, pass it backward, pass it some way. The business has been good to me. I wanted to be good to others. So that's how I did it. And I don't know how everybody else does it.
Now, I remember, kind of wrap this up here. I remember when I first met you, you'd come to share your experiences with continuing education in Tennessee. You came to visit us at the Kansas Baylades Association. And when we finally did get the legislation introduced, you were good enough to, you know, come and talk to the Kansas legislature on our behalf. And I don't know that we ever told you thank you. I certainly hope you did. If we didn't, let me extend our thanks now. It was vital to what we're still doing. And I can honestly say that I've learned a lot from just watching you and others in your position, the sort of the statesman of the bail bond industry, speak before my legislature. I do try and emulate the ease and the comfort you demonstrated when I have to go before legislatures, because I have to do that every year or so, go up and talk about something. So I just wanted to extend the thanks and that, you know, whether you know it or not, you've taught me things from just being able to watch you and how you did things in your roles in the past.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You're welcome. It was my pleasure, Shane.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. I hope that you're able to take some trips here pretty soon. I do appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about all this stuff.
All right, sir. Have a good day.
You too. Thanks a lot, Charlie.
Thank you for joining us today on the Bail in the Midwest podcast.